Good afternoon, and welcome back to the Afternoon Magazine. I'm Jim Meadows, sitting in for Celeste Quinn during this hour of the Afternoon Magazine to talk about Peanuts, the comic strip, which is still going strong years after it has stopped being drawn. As a matter of fact, if you open up a newspaper, certainly in the U.S., pretty good chance you'll see a Peanuts comic strip. Tonight on ABC, one of the Peanuts animated specials is running. Ballantine Books has published three Peanuts books this year. Another publisher is publishing the entire run of the strip in multiple hardback volumes. And if you haven't seen Peanuts toys and greeting cards during this Christmas season, you've probably not been in a shopping mall. What is it about this strip and the man who created it that keeps its reputation going nearly 8 years after its creator died? Well, Charles M. Schulz is the subject of a new biography by David Michaelis, which has been getting a lot of attention. The name of the book is Schulz and Peanuts. It's published by Harper. And David Michaelis is our guest from New York in this hour of the Afternoon Magazine. Welcome to the show.
Thanks, Jim. Great to be here.
You know, I was one thing I did today is I looked at the Peanut strip that ran in the paper today, at least at some of the papers, because apparently there are two different series being syndicated.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know if there's something you can tell by just one ordinary day strip that gives some idea as to what made Peanuts out of the ordinary. It's just a strip with Snoopy. He's in the first two panels, he's looking more or less like a dog, focused on something out of view.
Mm-hmm.
Then he sets off on a run, and then in the third panel, he is suddenly standing up on his hind legs and kicking a football.
Oh, he punts the ball, right. Yep.
He punts the ball.
Yeah.
And as he walks off, he thinks to himself, I had no idea that punting could be so soul-satisfying. And this is a strip from 1960. And, you know, when I look at it, I've been reading Peanuts all my life, but is there anything here that would have been out of the ordinary when Peanuts first came on the scene?
Well, in the first place, I think the idea of a dog standing up and kicking a football and then having such a radically simple thought, and as well as a radically complex thought at the same time, that the idea of punting is not just satisfying, but soul satisfying. I mean, that's to me where it becomes Peanuts, is that Snoopy can recognize in his own soul what is fundamental. And also, if you've ever put your foot on a football and punted it and actually made that, you know, sweet, where the football finds its sweet spot on the arch of your foot and you actually see that ball go flying through it, there is something quite deeply satisfying about punting football. But there's something about a dog identifying this for us and saying that it's part of our soul. I think that Schulz had been saying things like this since 1950 when it began, and I think he had, you know, he had inverted things. In the American vision of childhood, children were supposed to be indestructible. They were supposed to be very bouncy. But in Peanuts, the children all had their childhood happiness mortgage. You know, Schulz was creating this apparently secure world. There was no pollution. There were no adults. There was no speeding cars. And there were no shadows even. It was this world of steady daylight. You see it in that strip that you just mentioned, just constant, steady white light. Except that no one was really happy. If they were happy, they also became sad. And I think kids have this notion. There's this notion that childhood's supposed to be in America the happy time of life. But here were these kids saying all these things about not fitting in, about being depressed, and this was a subversive notion in American life in the 50s. It also mirrored, I think, the feelings beneath the surface of Eisenhower's America, and therefore people responded to it, I think.
Now the dog seemed pretty happy.
The dog is the official designated happy person in the strip. In fact, Snoopy is the one person who is allowed happiness uniformly, except for the fact that he's continuously deflated. He is brought back from his grandest dreams, his grandest flights of fancy, to the dog dish, where he is once more dependent on Charlie Brown and once more dependent on, well, on being a dog. And that's what he's been trying. From the moment that Schulz allowed Snoopy to dream and dream his dreams, he stopped being a typical dog. Before that, he had been a fairly typical dog. But now that he was a dreaming creature, it's being brought back to who he really is, a dog that is the most deflating part of his life. And I think that's where Snoopy does get his comeuppance time and again. But he also, as Charlie Brown will always try one more time to kick the football, doesn't ever quit. Snoopy always has one more dream. There's one more world-famous version of his grand themes that he will try out and try on.
Now, Charles Schulz, the guy who created Peanuts and drew it, you know, for nearly 50 years, was someone who, from your biography, was someone who wanted to be a cartoonist from very early on. It was something he really focused on. Why do you think being a cartoonist appealed to him?
Well, he had been a child of the Depression, and in his childhood, I think some of his happy moments and secure moments at home, his father was a barber who read the comics and read them aloud and read them with Sparky, his young son, and I think Schulz felt a sense of connection to the world of the comics through his father, whom he admired and revered, and a sense that comics were a place where things happened but didn't stick. Popeye, you know, could be clobbered by Bluto, but the next day he was back up and fighting again. And I think the lessons of the comics in Schulz's childhood were lessons that Americans felt at the time applied to them in the world. I mean, you were determined, you never quit. You were happy in the sense of your if your hope was alive, and I think he felt this continuously when he looked at the comics. He also had a visual sense, and clearly something that's indefinable, where he looked in there and he saw himself and found himself, found his talent, found that his hand was fluent when he followed along, following the lines of Tim Tyler's Luck or Flash Gordon as he made these early drawings. He describes his own childhood as being somewhat apart. He was somewhat defined by his sense of being an only child, a little bit apart from his boyhood friends. But I think when he decided he was going to be a comic strip artist, which he always said was when he was by the age of six, he had laid this out as his lifetime ambition, that he knew himself to be talented, but the world around him in Minnesota at the time, he knew himself to be extraordinary, and the world was saying to him, "Be ordinary. You know, don't think too well of yourself. Don't get a big head," was his father's constant refrain. And there, of course, he created a character, Charlie Brown, with an enormous head that he placed quite safely on a child's body.
And you know, I'm thinking, of course, you know, this is public radio. A lot of us have listened to Garrison Keillor, who talks about life growing up in Minnesota, and those same themes run in his work of mm-hmm. childhoods where people
yes.
were warned about putting on airs.
Absolutely, and the whole feeling that Lutheran world of Minnesota between the wars was a place where you didn't want to feel too good about yourself. Being unhappy was an antisocial rather than a personal emotion. You know, you exposed yourself to rebuke in this world if you revealed your unhappiness. You would betray the social contract if you ever showed how lonely or depressed you were. And I think for Schulz to introduce from that world of his childhood a set of children who openly discussed their unhappiness, openly discussed their loneliness, were actually cruel to each other in the earliest years of Peanuts, was quite subversive. You know, these children, these little cartoon creatures, so different from anything else in the comics at the time, were really willing to admit that just keeping the world going was exhausting, and they were philosophical about life's defeats. And I think that their actions, you know, their behavior, they're very much still a bunch of kids in the early days, but they're stoical. They don't cry. It's astonishing to see that and Charlie Brown just gets decked by these girls, the Violet and Patty in the early years, but he never cries. He never has any self-pity. There's never a moment where he looks at himself and says, "Oh, gee, this is awful." He just keeps trying again and again and again, despite all the rejection and all the loss.
And himself, when Charles Schulz was growing up and having these dreams of being a cartoonist,
mm-hmm.
he was being told that, you know, it's not really a real job.
Yeah, and I think also if you think, consider where Schulz came from. In Minnesota between the wars wasn't a place where you sure didn't support your family and put food on the table by doodling, by drawing. The dream of being a syndicated cartoonist earning $1,000 a week was as far away as saying, "I want to be an astronaut and go to the moon," or "I want to be a Hollywood director." And it was a very far-fetched notion, and that he should, without any help, no one around him knew how to help, and everyone wanted to help. It was, you know, a matter of, "Gee, I saw the ad in the paper today for the correspondence course. Why don't you try that, Sparky? You know, why don't you," or Carl Schulz, his father, would ask anyone who came in the barbershop who had anything even remotely to do with publishing, even the guy who, you know, who dropped the papers off in the corner, he'd say, "Do you think there's some way you can help Spark?" I mean, it was as if he was growing up in a place that it was as far from the center of comics as if he wanted to literally go to the moon. So I think that the remarkable thing about Charles Schulz is that he never quit, that he did stick with it all the way through. Well, the war, of course, took everyone away, took all young men's ambitions and turned them into soldiers' reality. And he came back from the war full of confidence about himself, but without any idea about how he was going to go about making this dream into reality.
He had only a correspondence school art education, and that seemed to be enough for him. He never really got anything more than that.
Yeah, he turned out Schulz was very much a native genius. He had a knack for little incidents, for seeing in life's daily events small revealing moments, sort of like the one you just mentioned. Even the idea of just kicking a football has a moment of satisfaction that goes as deep as saying you feel soul satisfied. Just little tiny moments became his stock in trade as he began selling cartoons to the Saturday Evening Post, developing a local strip for the Minnesota paper, the Pioneer Press, called Lil Folks, it was called. It was really very much that was a strip really much about the war between the sexes, little girls and little boys really battling it out in ways that the Peanuts characters did with far greater irony and sophistication in later years. But as Schulz moved forward and toward Peanuts, he discovered that he had a knack for sarcasm and quick wit and a kind of bright, odd, quirky way of seeing life's daily incidents. And that really became the thing he had to sell as he made the rounds of the syndicates. There was no acceptance right away even when Peanuts was launched by United Features Syndicate. It was not an overnight success. People had trouble understanding who all these characters were. Why do these kids look like they were sort of Alka-Seltzer ads? Why did they have such big, strange heads and small bodies? And why were most of the cartoon pages were filled with adventure strips, action strips? This was a very understated thing that he was doing, and it was different.
Why did he end up doing a comic strip, Children? Was he fated to have done so, or might he have done something else?
I think Schulz could possibly have remained in Minnesota for life as a sub guy at an advertising agency drawing illustrations for ads, but that wasn't who he was. Who he was someone who, he had a genius for popularizing the human condition, and he managed to find a way of making it look easy even when it wasn't. He managed to have that knack for radical simplicity. I mean, he really stripped down his statement, stripped down his strip, the drawing in it, in ways that no one had done before. He was also, and this is something of a surprise to me, because you hear from Schulz in later years, he's a bit of an aw shucks guy. He's a bit of a don't pay attention to me, I'm really just a nothing young man. I was a nothing young man from St. Paul. I'm just an ordinary Midwesterner. But the truth was, he was very ambitious. He had a real sense that he was destined to do something great, do something important. And even though he recognized this in himself, he didn't much bring it out. He didn't much want people to know that he had set his sights so high, lest he fail or lest they seem to be, a bit puffed up. It was a great sin, I think, of his childhood to think too well of yourself. And I think he was modest and appeared to be quite humble most of his life. And he recognized, I think, that this was something that made Peanuts understandable to people, that these kids appeared to be, quiet, unassuming kids. But in fact, there was so much going on. With the minute Lucy joined the strip, there was so much aggression, there was so much... Snoopy saying, "Don't you ever feel like just biting someone someday?" I think there was a way that Schulz made both melancholy in the Charlie Brown sense and aggression or aggressiveness or big thinking in the Snoopy sense really quite admirable and quite palatable and quite he harmonized things. He took joy and he harmonized it with sadness. When Charlie Brown says, "I'm depressed," or Charlie Brown feels disconnected at Christmas, There's something about those two things, those two notes played at the same time, that gives us that feeling we always have when we see Charlie Brown Christmas. That is how we feel at a time of joy. There is a little element of sadness that when you think of all the things you're missing.
We're talking with David Michaelis, the author of Schulz and Peanuts, a new biography of Peanuts creator Charles Schulz, published by Harper. And You're invited to call and post your own questions to David Michaelis. The number here at the Afternoon Magazine is 333-9455 in the 217 area code. If you're from further away, the number is 1-800-222-9455. And I believe we have one call already from St. Anne, Illinois. And caller, you're on the air. Welcome to the Afternoon Magazine.
Yeah, hi. Thanks for taking my call. A very enjoyable show. Couple of quick comments, a question, and I'll go ahead and ring off. For the listeners in the area, my 12-year-old daughter is doing the play Scrooge at Theater on the Center in Munster, and that facility has a gallery currently running on Charles Schulz. So if you find yourself in the area, it's very well put together, a very interesting gallery on his work, historical perspective. And actually, a couple of questions for your guest, and I'll ring off. In this gallery, there's a short video program that was made in 1963 with Mr. Schulz. And it said that it was never shown on TV, and the rumor is that it was slated to run around Thanksgiving in 1963, but because of the untimely assassination of the president, I guess it was shelved, and I don't know if there's any truth to that or not. And then what I took away from the gallery was somewhat estranged relationship that Charles Schulz had with his wife, and I was wondering if there was any truth to that, if you could speak on that. And then finally, the characters themselves, as you were mentioning, actually were derived from friends, neighbors, classmates, wondering if that was true. And then they said the personal fortune of Charles Schulz and what he built is quite immense. And I don't know if you've touched on that or not, but anyway, there's quite a bit there. Enjoying the conversation. I'll go ahead and ring off. Thank you.
Thank you, caller.
And I'm not sure about that 1963 show. I think it sounds logical that that would be the way things had worked out. I don't know it, though. I'm not sure which one it is. And as to the question of Schulz being estranged from his wife, he was married from 1951 to 1972 to Joyce Halverson, and their divorce was peaceful in 1972. They lived in very separate parts of the world. After all, she moved to Hawaii, and Charles Schulz continued to live in Northern California. And I suppose estrangement would be a way of putting it. I don't think so. I mean, I actually found letters from later years where Joyce Schulz wrote to congratulate Schulz on different achievements and on a brave stand he'd taken at one point. So I think there was friendliness there in the end. And he, of course, had a very happy second marriage, and his widow, Jean Schulz, is currently runs the Charles M. Schulz Museum and Research Center, which is there alongside the Redwood Empire Ice Arena in Santa Rosa, California. And his fortune is an odd thing, which is to say that it is quite true, I think, and not an exaggeration, to say that Peanuts, as a worldwide brand in the last 10 years or so, varies, but primarily brings in gross income. All products, all things Peanuts bring in about $1.2 billion a year. As best I can estimate from this, the Schulz would be himself grossing somewhere between 25 and 40 million. That's a broad stretch there, but somewhere between 25 and 40 million a year. He is listed quite frequently by the Forbes at Forbes.com and something called Earnings from the Crypt. The earnings of American, posthumous earnings of American entertainers. For a long time, in the 90s, Elvis was number one, Charles Schulz was number two, I think John Lennon was number three. This was disturbed briefly by Kurt Cobain when Cobain sold his catalog of songs. But Schulz continues to be one of those posthumous entertainers after his death, earning at a level that certainly was the way he had earned during his life. And his fortune itself is divided among a large family, and his syndicate. The most important thing to understand is that the syndicate, United Feature Syndicate, which owned from the beginning the copyright in Peanuts and was Schulz's partner in the brand of Peanuts, is absolutely a equal earner practically with Schulz in all that. So Schulz himself isn't making the kind of money that it sounds like he's making when you say a billion a year, but he certainly isn't making quite a good deal, or his estate is. And I think with the Charles Schulz Foundation set up in California, it goes all to the good and to charities and to causes that Schulz himself believed in and championed.
And it was certainly a lot more than Charles Schulz ever imagined that he'd be making.
Oh, well, Schulz walked into his father's barbershop in Minnesota on Selby Avenue, you know, in the 30s and said, listen, guys, I'm going to make, he said to the men sitting there having their haircut, I'm going to be making $1,000 a year someday. I'm going to be making $1,000 a week someday. Life magazine, you know, it just had a big spread on Frank King, the creator of Gasoline Alley, and it said that King made $1,000 a week, and Schulz set his sights on that quite preposterous amount of money at the time. The guys in the chairs just said, sure, Sparky, and waved him out the door. There was no chance that this boy was ever going to be making that kind of money. Well, he not only exceeded the wildest of expectations, but he created markets and subsidiary worlds for comics that had never even existed before. And the success of Peanuts was so far greater than any of its, and I mean, comics had always been branded and licensed, going back to Buster Brown and the Yellow Kid back at the turn of the century. There were any number of products created out of comic strip characters, but Schulz, in the many ways in which Peanuts was created, recreated in new media, and continues to this day to be found in so many media, really was the leader, and Schulz was a leader in creating the licensing and branding world that really didn't exist in any consistent way. That's the Peanuts products were marked by quality. There really were quality products, whereas before, often these products had followed flashes in the pan, fads, TV fads. I mean, there's that story of when Fress Parker was Davy Crockett, and of course the whole world was tuning in, and every kid wanted a coonskin cap, and there was a guy who was selling pup tents, and all he had to do was stencil Davy Crockett on the pup tents and sell them, and you know, he sold out a whole truckload within an hour. That kind of thing, where people were just cashing in on sudden fads, was very typical of the kind of products that were available in the earlier. Schulz's Peanuts products created a whole new consistent line, consistent brand, consistent levels of quality that had never been in the industry before.
I wanted to take up another question that our caller brought in, and then we'll go to another call who's waiting for us here in Champaign. And that's the role that people Charles Schulz knew played in the strip. And you certainly make it clear in the book that that a lot of the characters carry the names of people that Charles Schulz knew. Some of them look a little bit like some of the people Charles Schulz knew. For instance, there was a Charlie Brown that he worked with at the Art Instruction School. Was Charlie Brown, the Charles Francis Brown of Schulz's acquaintance, anything like Charlie Brown?
Well, I think that there are similarities that you can see in Charlie Brown in terms of the Charlie Francis Brown, in terms of his insecurities, in terms of his sense that the world might not work out the way he wants it to, but that he's going to get up every day and keep trying, that he's determined, that he's not a quitter. A lot of that kind of thinking came not just from Charlie Brown, but from another colleague, Frieda Rich, who was, of course, her name was given to Frieda, the girl with the naturally curly hair in the comic strip. But Frieda in life was both a little person, she was a woman, she was Jewish, she was Canadian, and she was teased mercilessly about all those things. But she had the kind of character that never bowed to any of it. No matter how much teasing was dished out, she got right back up and went about her artwork, went about her life, and knew that she was bigger than all of that. And I think that kind of irreducible strength is a hallmark of what Schulz imbued the Peanuts characters with. He gave to each one parts of his own personality, parts of his own character. To Schroeder, he gave his devotion to art, his perfectionism, his ability to make great things out of a small piano, out of a small instrument. Comics were seen as a small instrument, but Schulz was, as Schroeder coaxed Beethoven from that small toy piano, so Schulz created Coke's greatness from the media and the comic strip. He gave to Charlie Brown his own sense of apartness. He gave to Lucy his own sarcasm, his own sense that that one was occasionally mean to one's nearest and dearest in a completely sarcastic way. And he gave, I think, each character some part of himself that's quite discernible. He used the names of his art instruction colleagues. This was the school where he had been student as a correspondence student, but he taught there, and the friends he made there were other artists and other cartoonists who were quite ambitious and were very bright, and he admired them, and he gave Linus Maurer's name to Linus Van Pelt in Colorado Springs in 1951 when he and his wife first moved there for a brief time. They got to know Phil or Fritz and Lou Van Pelt, Lou Ann Van Pelt. So the Van Pelt name stuck with Lucy and Linus, who were being created at that time. Each child of his offered a kind of one of his children was a sort of a pig pen prototype. Another, they were all blanket carriers. Devices that came into the strip came from his observations of children and of his family. Bits and pieces of life came into Peanuts as Schultz experienced life and thought back on his own life. And I think it really was a very personal document in the end. It was almost like a diary in some sense. I was surprised frequently as I looked into the comic strip how much of his own life he was bringing into what we all knew to be Peanuts.
I want to go, let's go to our caller now. We have a caller from Champaign waiting on the line. And good afternoon. You're on the air.
Hi.
Hello.
Can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
Yeah, okay. My question is, in later years, I didn't find the Peanuts comic terribly funny. And I was surprised. I went back to some of the earlier stuff. I just had a book, you know, lying around of earlier Peanuts comics, how funny they were, how clever they were. And I've heard other people comment on how, you know, the later stuff was kind of a shadow of the work that Schultz had done earlier. I even wondered if there was some kind of a shadow artist doing it or something like that. But I would like to hear our guest comment on that, if that's something that he's run across or has an explanation for that.
Well, there are a couple things about it that are very, and it's a great question, because, and it's a constant discussion, by the way, I think, among people who care about Peanuts and who read it in the beginning and continued reading it or didn't. And I think that the first thing is that Schultz never gave his passed on his pen to an assistant in any way, that every single one was his own, was the work of his own hand, and everything was written by him. But Schultz from 80 to 2000, let's say broadly, really felt that he himself felt that he was doing some of his best work, and that there were times where he would try to push the strip into new forms. He began using captions rather than thought balloons. He began using single panel presentations where before there had been four, and then he worked it down to three, and now he was doing often single ideas and single panels that he thought were quite unique and were quite different. I think one of my personal senses is that aging was a difficult process for Schultz, and that aging as it crept into the strip as a theme slowed the strip down in ways that I think he never quite solved. He himself would look at a character like Rerun, who was, of course, Lucy and Linus's youngest brother, who a character created in these later years. He never felt that Rerun became a real comic strip character, that Rerun's limitations were always present, that Rerun appeared on the back of his mother's bicycle, Rerun could do jokes with Linus and Lucy, but there was a limit somehow, and he never found the key. Pigpen was somewhat the same way, even though Pigpen was a universal character from earlier years. After he did 40 jokes about the dirt, that was pretty much that. I think in the end, also, the characters became adults. There is no question. Lucy turns to Charlie Brown frequently in the later years and asks his opinion. I mean, this is the girl who was nailing him, who was demolishing him in earlier years, and it was always a question of how was she going to demolish him. And even the gag of the football, every year in the fall, Lucy would pull it away, and each time Charlie Brown would run up, and of course he'd miss it, and of course each time we would be waiting to see how this time she had foiled him in her own mind. What was it? What trick had she created for him? What trap had she set by something he'd said or something they'd agreed on? And even she said in the later years, gosh, this is beginning to seem sort of routine. I think the characters began to seem adult, even Snoopy with his young scouts, the Woodstock birds, following him when he was the scoutmaster. Even he began to sort of take on adult responsibilities. And Charlie Brown hit a home run. I mean, that was peculiar, that Charlie Brown would actually succeed. That seemed impossible. Of course, he never did kick the football. Schultz was discussing that even to the last in his last interview. Yeah. But I think he never tired of the devices that he had set up. And he knew that people didn't want change, but they did want variation. And he was a master at variation. But I think that some of the characters, Sally was another one who kind of trudged around a little bit. Lucy looks matronly. It just doesn't have quite that snap. Linus seemed a little out of focus in later years. But, you know, the thing about Peanuts is that don't ever say never, because you'll find a strip one day in 1996 that'll just knock your socks off. And one more time, Charles Schulz just nails it. So with every artist, you have your days and you have your days. But I think on balance, if you look at the whole 50 years, everyone would agree that it is one of the great works of art and insights into the human condition.
Okay, thank you, caller. And David, I wanted to go a little bit further on that, because you talked in the book about the influence that Charles Schulz's first wife had on the Lucy character. And you make a note of that in saying that Lucy changed, really mellowed, when Charles Schulz divorced and remarried.
I think that the tensions and dynamics of his first marriage are clearly on view, both in the Peanuts comic strip and in the memories of people who knew the Schulzes at that time. It was in some ways, a very dynamic household, because on the one hand, Schulz was somewhat passive and she was somewhat aggressive, and she was a completely externalized force, and he had his internal life, and she was very much out there with people, and he was sort of reserved. So they were a classic couple in some ways, and in many ways, when you look at Charlie Brown and Lucy and see how they went about interacting with one another through those years of the 60s, you see the dynamic of a marriage. Or you see, for instance, with Lucy, as she lay at the end of the piano beckoning Schroeder, trying to get his attention, Schroeder with his head down, buried in the piano, in art itself and in his devotion to it, doesn't need her. And I think Schulz at the drawing board was a guy who, boy, you'd come in, and of course he was available to his children to play baseball, and he was available to friends, but he was a man devoted to his art, single-mindedly devoted to his art. And my sense of what Joyce Schulz contributed to Schulz's art was immeasurable, particularly in the fact that it was she who made sure they moved to California, a great place to be in the late 50s and early 60s. The entire country was, or the mass migration that was taking place to California was one of the largest in American history, and Major League Baseball was moving to the West Coast, and jet travel was now going to the West Coast, and TV was going to the West Coast. And here was Charles Schulz and his family in 1958 moving at his wife's insistence, at Joyce's great, she was very ambitious, and out they went. And they were part of a real national moment through that period, just simply being in California, being part of that healthy, clean living, you know, sunny environment. And I think it shows when you look at Peanuts in those years how it changed and became very, very much an expression of our national life. And I think that that she was a constant influence on him that way.
At the same time, you do make a point of saying that, you know, when there was irritation in Charles Schulz's life, frustration, personal problems, his strip only seemed to get better.
Mm-hmm. I think that like all ours, he took his own sense that life was full of unhappiness, and he harmonized it with the idea that every life is going to have both. And I think that you see it constantly in Peanuts. In April 1960, Lucy, for instance, embraces Snoopy one day. She just walks along, and there he is, and she embraces him, and then delivers this what would become this line. She says, happiness is a warm puppy," and Snoopy lets himself be nuzzled. Well, the next time that Lucy tries to cuddle up, I think it was by then October 1960, she tries to cuddle up in October, now months later, and this time Snoopy tosses her off, he bares his paws, and he thinks, "Phooey, my mother didn't raise me to be a heating pad." 4 years later, when Linus hugs Snoopy, and this time, you know, the embrace just sort of startles the dog, Linus stands back and says, "What's so happy about a warm puppy?" This is Schulz. This is classic Schulz saying on the one hand, happiness is this wonderful thing that's universal, it's warm. On the other hand, what's so happy about it? What is all this? I think he was constantly bringing into the public discourse the two sides of every question. And in fact, it was astonishing to see how often a single cartoon would be claimed by both sides of a national debate. There's one where Sally comes in. She finds Charlie Brown eventually at the bottom panel of a big, long Sunday strip, having looked all over the house for him. She finds him, and they get behind the sofa, and she whispers a secret to him. She says, "We prayed in school today." Well, both sides of the prayer in school debate that was then raging in the country, both wanted that strip for their newsletters, for their campaign, to support their side of this cause. And Schultz himself had his own private feelings about whether prayer did or didn't belong in school. He frankly didn't think that there should be, that children should be required to pray. The prayer had its place, of course, in life and in church, but the children shouldn't be demanded that they show and demonstrate faith publicly in school, that it was a private matter. And he didn't think that the school should legislate. But none of that mattered. That he gave permission to neither side. He didn't support the one or the other. He kept his opinions to himself, and he created a work of art that commented so universally on things that people of all kinds responded to it. I think one of his great strokes of genius, and I think it was intuitive with him, was never to offer the answers, never to say during a time such as the 60s when everybody was looking for the answers, I've got the answer. And he became, as a result, timeless. He became universal. He became forever the guy that people go to for a relief, I think, in some sense, from the national discourse, even though he was constantly making comments about it. I think people went to him for reassurance, for security, for a sense that life was full of all kinds of possibilities.
At the same time, Schultz was an evangelical Christian. I mean, certainly
yep.
a group that was confident in having answers. He was active in his church
yep.
of God of Anderson, Indiana. He drew a cartoon for a church youth magazine. What role did that play in his strip?
Well, he brought, it's curious because, and it's one of those things I puzzled through over and over, because by, not to avoid the question, but just to set the background, by 1975, he was saying very different things about faith, about what God didn't want. He was of the belief, for instance, by 1975, that God did not want to be worshipped, that he wanted us to love each other. He described himself in his later years, that is around from 73, 74, 75 onward, as a secular humanist. That's a distinct difference from an evangelical Christian. He resisted labels by and large.
But it was still part of...
What he brought into the strip was a sense that Scripture itself could have a place in the dialogue of comic strip characters, that they could find truths in Scripture, that they could discuss the Bible, that Linus's ever-present questioning of faith, as you see him waiting for the great pumpkin, was part of our lives and should be acknowledged as such. But if you really look at the Peanuts canon, at the whole 50 years, and consider, I suppose, St. Paul's three tenets of Christian faith, love, faith, and hope, you don't find a great deal of this in Peanuts. I mean, those children aren't loving of one another. They're tolerant of one another. There is a great deal of love for them. Snoopy is a beloved character to us, but not so much to Charlie Brown, and certainly not to Lucy. Most of his antics are tolerated. Except for Linus and the Great Pumpkin, you don't see many expressions of faith. And in fact, there's finally a cartoon where Snoopy's extremely worried about what's going to happen to him existentially, and bangs on Charlie Brown's door in the middle of the night and comes in from the doghouse, and Charlie Brown embraces him and says, you know, be reassured, don't worry, little friend. You know, tomorrow the famine will end and the floodwaters will recede and the sun will come back out and life will be okay. You know, go back and sleep on your doghouse and be reassured. Things will work out. And then Charlie Brown goes back upstairs himself to his bed and pulls the comforter, the quilt up to his chin and says, who reassures the reassurer? And there's no answer. That's the last panel. He doesn't say God is the answer. He doesn't say that he has the answer. He just lets Charlie Brown pose that question to a world in which maybe there isn't going to be an answer. So I think Schultz left it to us to decide. And it wasn't a... people often said in those years when he wasn't identified an evangelical Christian that he was using the Peanuts comic strip as a pulpit to express Christian ideas in ways that he might not otherwise have done. I'm not sure that's true at all. I think he was very, very strict about what did and didn't go into that comic strip, and I don't think he was using it in any way except to entertain us, to make us look a little differently at the comics, to make us think a little more.
And I was thinking of that I was reading a Peanuts book from the early 1990s, so pretty late in the run, and this would be the time when, as you describe it, Schultz would think of himself as a secular humanist or would have those sort of ideas. But religion was still in his mental furniture, and there were strips mm-hmm. there where some of the characters are teaching younger kids in Bible class. And Other ones were just in school. Characters are bringing up biblical quotations. It seems as something that was still something he was thinking about.
I think he always wanted people to think about... I think he was the speaker of the unspeakable. And when you think about our popular culture, it's not a place where religion or where the ideas of Christianity or the doubts about Christianity come into play. I mean, when Schultz was making with Lee Mendelson and Bill Melendez the Charlie Brown Christmas, the special that you know that's on right now at this time of year in 1965, and they took it to CBS. The whole mission of television at that time was to please everyone and offend no one, which meant really not even saying there was such a thing as religion. But Schultz had insisted that in this question raised by the story in Charlie Brown's Christmas, what is the meaning of the season? You know, what does this mean to us? Why has this become so commercial? Linus, you know, there at the auditorium says, "Lights, please." And a spotlight hits him, and he, in clear, simple language, or I should say the clear, simple language of the Gospel of St. Luke, speaks the truth, as he knows it, of the nativity, of the coming of Christ to the world. I think that that was a radical, radically simple moment in American culture. It was the moment that people responded to that night, every day, every year thereafter. The way the critics described it the next day in Variety, you know, they said all heaven broke loose last night on CBS. People were aware that something new had happened, and ironically, it was simply by bringing the meaning of Christ back into Christmas, and that was a radical notion at the time. It had no political agenda. It wasn't politicized. It wasn't part of some movement that Schultz felt the world needed to be part of. He simply wanted to speak a truth and remember what it was that made people think about Christmas in the way that they felt it in their hearts.
You know, I was thinking in looking at your book, you write a lot about how Charles Schultz regarded the strip, and he certainly had a firm idea of what the strip should be and when he was doing it well. At the same time, you also talk about how he worried that what he was doing wasn't really important. Mm. I remember one portion you mentioned him pretty late in life bemoaning the fact that he hadn't done something important by Andrew Wyeth,
right?
For instance, and you've written a biography of Andrew Wyeth's father, N.C. Wyeth, who also, like Charles Schultz, worked in the commercial realm.
Yes.
And from what I gathered, also worried that his work wasn't important. Are there similarities between these two men as far as their work is involved?
I think they both brought out from a form that was considered second rate or not pure or not pure art, work that was incomparable and that was clearly of the first order, and that when you recognize the American comic strip as an original American art form, and you recognize American illustration in its golden age in the turn of the century and into the teens and 20s, when Wyeth was producing Treasure Island and Robinson Crusoe and Robin Hood, you can see that these are masters of a form that is itself potentially great, but is held back quite often by its translation into commercial reproduction. I mean, the N.C. Wyeth would paint highly colorful canvases, knowing that they were going to be muddied in the reproduction process. Schultz made his comic strip characters larger and did less. He simplified. He made less out of them. He made them into starker figures because he knew that the panels around them were going to be shrunk. They were originally sold as space-saving devices to newspaper editors. If an editor had a composition problem in the classified ads or anywhere else in the paper for that matter, they could throw peanuts in as a vertical strip, as a square of four boxes, as a horizontal strip. It was going to solve people's composition problems, makeup problems in the newspaper. Schultz realized that to get anyone's attention, he had to have more white space. He had to say simpler things in more clearer statements, fewer words. And that kind of limitation that a commercial medium put on someone ended up being an artistic virtue. The same thing for Wyeth. He painted in greater values. He painted in greater, his color, his palette became practically postmodern simply because of the problems he was facing as a commercial artist. And I think those kinds of, the I think it was Goethe who said that the master shows his mastery in the limitations. And I think when limitations were placed on Schultz as on Wyeth, that's when he really showed his stuff. And again, it's the same thing of being absolutely determined and absolutely ambitious. They both knew what they wanted, how good they wanted their work to be, how difficult it was going to be to get there. And I think it added a certain quality to it, that the richness of Schultz's achievement is partly because comics weren't considered an art form, and you can see a man developing his art in this form and creating something much greater than anyone could have expected.
The book is Schultz and Peanuts, a biography of Peanuts creator Charles M. Schultz. It's by David Michaelis and published by Harper. David, thank you very much for being our guest this hour in the Afternoon Magazine. I have another hour's worth of questions, but we're going to have to break it off here.
My absolute pleasure, Jim. Thank you.